Hello and welcome back to Insiders Capital. I'm Pierre Daly. My special guest today is Tim Nash, founder and CEO at Good Investing. Tim is the kind of person who looked at the traditional investing world, saw a huge gap, and decided to build the thing he wished existed. He founded Good Investing to help Canadians put their money where their values are, literally, by showing them how to build portfolios that reflect what matters to them, not just what shows up on a performance chart. Armed with a bachelor in economics from Dalhousie, Tim went deep on sustainability, earning a master's degree in strategic leadership towards sustainability from the Blekinge Institute of Technology in Sweden. That academic experience shaped his worldview. The economy isn't separate from the environment or society, and our investment choices shouldn't be either. Tim's early career mixed teaching economics with writing as the sustainable economist, where he broke down sustainable investing in plain, approachable language. The more he taught, the clearer it became to him that people wanted guidance, real guidance on how to invest intentionally without needing a PhD or $1 million minimum. That realization pushed him to launch Good Investing in 2017. Since then, he's helped thousands of Canadians build portfolios that feel right financially and ethically. Along the way, he's become a trusted voice in the media, appearing on CBC, BNN Bloomberg, and in the Globe and Mail, and hosting conversations about impact investing and the future of finance. So tune in. Because if you've ever wondered how to invest with intention, not just for return, but in a way that's aligned with your values, Tim Nash's journey might just serve as your roadmap.
This is Insiders Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Tim, welcome. It is great to have you back on the show.
Pierre, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Tim, it's been quite a controversial year politically, economically, in markets. What's been your take?
Sure. This year, 2025, oh my goodness, I would say is very much the culmination of what I would consider to be the anti-ESG this backlash against ESG, which right. is a movement that has been rising over the last couple of years. And in my mind, it's really kind of calmed down. The journey, as you mentioned, I've been at this for, about 15 years all in, really focused as a financial planner for almost the last 7 or 8 years. When I first started, when I came out and got my CFP and started speaking publicly about sustainable investing, I'd say there was a lot of curiosity. People had never heard of it, had lots of questions for me. It was really thoughtful. From there, once COVID hit in 2020, it was all the rage for a hot minute. It was like, wow, everyone wanted to talk to me and, so many opportunities and there was so much interest. It was very much the hot thing. And then a few years after that, I'd say in about 2022, when the market downturn happened, sort of we had the tech bubble pop a little bit there, and certainly the bond market, had a terrible year in 2022. Things really soured and we started to see this big backlash against sustainability. And that's where there were a lot of criticisms, critiques, certainly south of the border. It's extremely political with a lot of the kind of anti-ESG, anti-DEI, broadly sort of anti-woke rhetoric. So what I'd say now, my line for, this year for 2025 is that the ESG tourists are gone. That anyone who was in it for, the wrong reasons, because it was a hot trend or, something they wanted to sort of, attach their ship to, really they're gone. They've left. What we're left with are the people who really do care, who really are passionate, who are knowledgeable. And I would say that, it's probably been a good thing for the industry. There was a fair bit of greenwashing that took place where, a lot of firms who weren't really into it, launch products or services aligned with it. And that's the, those are now basically left by the wayside. And that what's left is, I would say, a much stronger, more consolidated aspect of sustainable investing.
Ironically, it also, this idea that you can control how people should feel about something by force has the opposite effect for those who actually do really care about it. And so in a way, like, it's given way to people feeling more strongly about it. Just like the economic attack on Canada this year has made people feel more nationalistic, more, you know, prideful of Canadian heritage and our values. You know, this idea that, and I think it's done that globally. I don't think it's just us, but I think everybody has sort of, you know, withdrawn from the attack and taken stock of themselves and said, well, maybe we do need to take another look at our own situation internally. But I think it's given rise to people really getting back in touch with their values, sort of, you know, writ large, you know, what does matter to you? So it's an interesting time for us to have this conversation for sure. How do you see, like, you know, you mentioned the debate. How do you see the current debate around sustainable/responsible investing? What do you think is driving the intensity of the conversation right now?
You know, I think we are at a bit of a pivotal moment right now, Pierre. And, you know, I'll go big picture for a moment, and then maybe we can drill down into some specifics. But I think there is a bit of a, I'll say, a clash of worldviews taking place right now. And we're seeing this play out in business, in politics, in, you know, neighborhoods, at dining room tables, you know, within families. And that I really think that there is, you know, one notion which is just so, I'm going to use the word, obsessively focused on wealth and growth at all costs. And this notion, you know, from an individual perspective, that your net worth equals your self-worth. That the biggest measure of someone's success is simply how much money they have in their, you know, bank account, investment accounts, their net worth. And I think that on the other side of the table, you've got people saying, whoa, wait a minute. You know, money is not the end in of itself. Money is simply a means to an end. What are the things that are really important that money can buy me? Well, they can buy me things like leisure time. They can buy me stability. They can buy me freedom, right? They can buy security for me and my family, right? Understanding that there are these larger ends around well-being, around happiness, right? That are actually more important than the single bottom line of just how much money I've got. And so to me, there's a real tension here because certainly, you know, there are a lot of folks who are very wealthy in this world, who have a lot of power in this world, are really using their wealth and their power to sort of put their thumb on our political scales. And, you know, and that frankly, I would say there are a lot of market failures happening in our current capitalist system. And I think a lot of us are just saying, hey, geez, like, this just isn't working anymore. You know, what good is having, you know, a higher GDP if it means that, you know, I have to look at the air quality report in the morning to decide whether I can take my baby out on the front porch because there are forest fires, or if I've got to have an emergency kit because there are forest fires, it's fire season, and at any moment I might have to, you know, get out and take my family and get out of Dodge very quickly. So I think there is a reprioritization taking shape. I think that, you know, many of us have been having these questions now for a couple decades, saying, hey, wait a minute, what comes after, you know, this pursuit of sort of infinite economic growth? You know, and there's got to be something more important here. But then at the same time, there's so many vested interests that want to keep the system as is. And so they're very much doing their best to kind of keep the status quo and really use their power to be able to kind of keep us in this box.
Yeah. So either you believe climate change is a complete hoax, or it's the biggest existential threat to humanity.
That's it.
You know, there's very little room in between, you know, for, you know, yeah, but I, you know,
this
Tim,
is it.
I think it would be very helpful, you know, especially like, because there are so many, there is so much vernacular, so much, you know, language being tossed around, and what does it all mean? It would be very helpful if we could unpack the difference in definitions between responsible investing, ESG, sustainable, sustainability, impact investing, all of the various terms and what they mean.
Yeah, let's do it. So I've, you know, I love mapping this out. I think this is so critical to having a productive, nuanced conversation about this is, you know, just getting on the same page. So what I talk about is sort of the headline, the big sort of, you know, title. We used to call it responsible investing. I mean, before that, it was socially responsible investing, SRI. And then we kind of dropped the social because, you know, it's more than that. So we start calling it responsible investing. For a long time, it was ethical investing in religious circles. Now, I would say that headline is more what I use is sustainable investing, you know, and these are all very much like big picture headline, you know, top of the system descriptions. And then from there, I kind of split up what I'm going to call sustainable investing into two different approaches, what I call doing less evil versus doing more good. Now, on the doing less evil side, the goal here is really to earn market rates of return, but do it in a way that, you know, we feel a little bit better about. So the three main tactics that we can use is number one, divestment. Just saying, hey, not one penny in a certain, this is the old ethical, right, where we talk about sin stocks of tobacco and weapons and pornography and gambling and, right? And that's just, nope, I will not one penny into those things. So the term for that is divestment. Or if we want to be a little more technical, we can talk about negative screens or exclusions, where, you know, we look at a whole universe and we say, hey, we're going to screen out these specific things. And okay, we have the rest of the universe just minus those exclusions. The second approach we have, which is the one that has really grown in popularity over the last 5 to 10 years, is ESG, Environmental Social Governance Analysis. So this is now, this is a research tool, Pierre. This is really about getting more information. So we've always done the financial analysis. I mean, how many of us have poured through a company's financials and, you know, we've got standards when it comes to accounting. But, you know, we realized that, wait a minute, the financials don't tell the whole story. What about things like, you know, whether a company is polluting or not? What about how a company treats their employees and this notion of employee retention? Right. Well, what about things like governance? Like, you know, this whole thing with the CEO also being the chair of the board and some of the conflicts that arise from that. You know, these are huge non-financial aspects of a company that are absolutely important to a company's long-term profitability, but we just never looked at them. They never showed up on an income statement or a balance sheet, so they were effectively ignored for the longest time. Well, now, hey, we're starting to look at those. So the ESG data has come so far. It used to be really hard getting this information. Now we have wide coverage. You know, companies like Morningstar, MSCI, Bloomberg, you know, all offer this ESG data and analysis. So the ESG piece, you know, it's still saying, hey, okay, I don't mind investing in, you know, a tobacco company, right? But I just want to know, you know, which of the tobacco companies are sort of operating a little bit better than the other ones, right? And so with ESG, it is much more of a risk perspective, right? And what we're trying to do is use this extra financial information to be able to make smarter decisions. The last strategy when it comes to doing less evil is what we call stewardship or shareholder engagement. Right. So this is the idea that companies have AGMs and as shareholders, you know, we get a vote every year at the AGM. Now, I don't expect people to actually show up to the AGM. I've had a couple clients who would say, hey, I want to go. You know, I'm actually going to show up in person and vote. No, no, no. Most of us own funds. Those funds are going to have things called proxy voting guidelines. But this is the idea that sometimes investors will get together and put forward a motion at a company's AGM, and then investors will vote yay or nay. And that obviously us sustainable investors probably have a preference for voting our shares towards companies that are going to push those companies forward, you know, on some of these issues. So all of those return, all of those tactics, divestment, ESG, and stewardship are all still very broad-based, super diversified investment strategies, earn market rates of return. You don't have to sacrifice one iota. There's really no deviation. You might pay higher fees for funds that do that. You know, there's a bit of an argument there, but it's usually only a few basis points these days. So, you know, really what we're doing there is still earning the same market rates of return, but investing in a way that is more aligned with our values. The other side of the equation is doing more good. And this is where, you know, I get a little more excited. Right. I think it's a little more impactful. But at the same time, you know, there are more considerations from a financial lens. So we kind of break that up into two tactics. The first is what we call thematic investing. And this is where we can invest part of our portfolio into themes like renewable energy, clean tech, water infrastructure. There are funds aligned to the UN Sustainable Development Goals. There are lots and lots of different options here. We've seen the rise of thematic funds. Oh my goodness. There are so many options available there. But this is where obviously we're putting a bet on those themes. If the theme outperforms, we do better. If the theme underperforms, we do worse. So there's certainly a lot more deviation there. It's not as diversified, you know, depending on the theme. Some of them are very narrow. So you got to be really careful there. And then the piece that I love the most is impact investing. With impact investing, we're really coloring outside the lines here, Pierre. This is where we're getting out of the stock market. You know, we're looking at things like community bonds. We're investing in nonprofits, in renewable energy cooperatives, in really sort of, you know, things like affordable housing groups where, you know, we're typically investing directly with a nonprofit or a co-op. To be able to, you know, really provide them with capital, lower their cost of capital in a way where, again, we probably are sacrificing either taking more risk or lower returns. We often call these concessionary investments where we are conceding a little bit on the financial side, but in order to have a very direct positive impact. And then usually on an issue that aligns with us. So that's kind of how I map it out. So when I'm with a client, you know, it really is about understanding, okay, what are your goals? What are we trying to achieve here? I always talk about sort of putting your own oxygen mask on first. So we usually start with the doing less evil approaches, get something that's going to earn market rates of return that very much aligns with their values. They can sort of hold their nose. It won't be perfect, but they can sort of hold their nose and feel good knowing that, hey, they're at least, you know, doing something there. And then for the clients that are a little bit more radical, that want to sort of, you know, challenge the system a little bit more, you know, but also those who frankly are a little bit more privileged, who maybe have enough that they're very much ahead of the curve on their retirement goals, you know, that's where we can carve out a bigger part of the portfolio for those thematic investments and those impact investments, knowing that we are going to see returns deviate there. Right. It's not necessarily that you're sacrificing, but that, you know, that we're going to see deviations compared to those normalized rates of return. But really, that's where they can feel really good about it. And what I find is that for a lot of folks, it is just carving out even 1% or 3% of their portfolio for the impact investment, that sort of crunchy granola stuff, that really is what's going to let them feel really good about the whole process. And allow them to sort of stick to the plan when it comes to the rest of their much more diversified portfolio.
Yeah. Interesting about impact as part of the portfolio, as part of an investment portfolio, it seems to have a most like a charitable feel as well to it, right? Where you're like you said, it lowers the cost of capital for nonprofits. In terms of impact investing, where it tends to channel towards more, you know, foundational or charitable work, like community, for example, you know, making investments in your local community that has an immediate impact in your own neighborhood or in your own, you know, your own realm, that you can see for yourself when you drive past it. I can see that where that would be something people could definitely feel good about. Doesn't that fall more under the umbrella of charitable giving rather than investment? Or is
it's all part of a package, right?
Yeah.
Like any good advisor, you know, financial planner, we should be having a conversation about charitable donations as part of an overall plan. You know, most people are really comfortable carving out part of their expenses for charitable giving. And, you know, that's a very normal thing to do. And so to me, it's the same exact thing when it comes to your investment portfolio. And you've nailed it, Pierre, that, you know, oftentimes these things are, the term we use is place-based, right? So they are sort of a local impact. But, you know, when I'm walking my dog in my neighborhood and I see folks living in tents in parks and knowing that there are certain parks that I don't go to, right? And that this is something that affects, or I see, you know, a food bank, you know, my neighbors lined up for the food bank. And I say, geez, what can I do about this? And there is a community land trust in my neighborhood that is actively, you know, buying up property to be able to keep it affordable for folks. And, you know, one of, in my mind, the best solutions to the affordable housing crisis. But they need money. How are they going to, you know, get the initial capital that they need to be able to purchase the building? Well, they issue community bonds. I can now, you know, put $1,000 into a community bond, right? I'm going to feel good about it every time I walk by, to your point. And so the language we often use is this idea of blended returns when it comes to impact investing, where, you know, normally it's risk versus return is the equation we're looking at. Well, now I use my very scientific language. I talk about risk versus return plus warm fuzzies. Now, everyone's going to have a different idea of what those warm fuzzies are, you know, and for some people, they won't have them. And hey, if you, you know, don't want to help those folks, or you don't care about affordable housing, and that's just not something that's going to give you warm fuzzies, this is not for you. But if you are someone that wants, you know, that does get those warm fuzzies, again, this is a really good way where, you know, at a small allocation, it's not really going to have an impact. These things are generally completely uncorrelated to the broad markets, right? So in 2022, when the bond market dropped, hey, my community bonds kept their par value. I mean, they're not liquid, right? So it's how much of that is perceived. But at the same time, it's just, you know, they just kept chugging along. So it felt very, very stable to me. And then, and this is a way to have an impact. And, you know, to your point, there is a bit of an alignment with philanthropy. I often refer to impact investments as recyclable philanthropy, because when I give money to my local food bank, you know, we do that every year. And then next year, you know, they're asking me for money again, that for them to have sustainability, right? They need that money. Whereas when I'm investing in a community bond, well, you know, I'm loaning them $1,000.
Right.
Well, at the end of the term, I get $1,000 back. I can now reinvest that. What I'm doing is helping these nonprofits achieve financial sustainability, right? Because they now own their real estate.
Right. So they can stay in business doing what they're doing. Right.
This is it. So to me, it is this idea of recyclable philanthropy. And yeah, you know, if we compare it to market rates of return, yeah, okay, I'm probably conceding returns. But if I compare my $1,000 community bond that's earning me a 4% annual interest rate versus a charitable donation, which is a negative 100% return, hey, I'm actually doing pretty well here. Now, I'm not saying, you know, don't donate money. Again, I think that for me, I look at people as a financial planner. We look at the different buckets. The people that I work with are making conscientious decisions about where they work and how they earn their revenue, right? And want that to be aligned. They're looking at how they spend their money and what companies they're purchasing from, right, through their expenditures. They're absolutely making donations, you know, charitable donations. This is a way of now an extra tool in their tool belt of using part of their investment portfolio to be able to achieve that positive impact.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I'm sitting here listening to you with my advisor hat on. But what's interesting about this discussion is that, you know, from an investing point of view, it might not necessarily check off all the boxes if it's just about, you know, what returns can we get from here. But from a purposeful frame, like, I mean, if folks are coming to you to get your help to align how they invest their money and how they spend their money and how they invest, you know, how they can give back to their community in a productive way, I don't think at the quarterly review or the annual review, they're sitting there looking at the line item and say, well, this thing's not performing. Why did we do that? Because they decided that it was very intentional, right? They'll look at that and say, yeah, that's an intentional line item that I chose to contribute to community bonds, for example. So I'm not really concerned about how that, you know, that $1,000 or $10,000 or $20,000 investment is doing, because I know there's risk that the project fails. I might not get my money back, but the point of doing it is to make sure that it doesn't fail, right? So the fear of loss is at odds with the purpose. I don't think people are going to sit there and you know, question you, Tim, you know, like, why, can you remind me why we did that again?
Yeah.
You know, well, because that was the whole point. That was the whole point of the discussion in the first place, right? So you're not going to get that. But I think if you're an advisor and you're approaching things strictly from the return standpoint, and you're, let's say you're talking to your clients about sustainable investing or impact investing from strictly an investment standpoint, if you sell it that way, then there's a very good possibility that down the road, that same client will turn around and say, well, you know, you told me all about this thing, but it's not really doing as well as our other portfolio components. So But from a from approaching the discussion from the standpoint of purpose and meaning and values, I can see where it's a whole, maybe the approach is what's wrong, right? The approach towards sustainable investing, like if advisors have clients who are interested in this or who they are talking to about this, it's the frame that matters. It's how you frame it. It's not just it's going to be lower risk and the same return, but with lower risk, risk-adjusted return perspective. Because if you set those expectations and it doesn't pan out, you're going to be having a whole other discussion around that, and that's where, if it's not very clear in the client's, in the investor's mind, or the client's mind, then it's a disappointment.
No question.
But if it has meaning, then it's no longer blah, blah, blah. It's I know why we did that. I'm aligned with that. I chose that. I think, I chose not to invest in tobacco. I chose not to invest in armament or in weapons of war. The military industrial complex. I chose not to do that. So if we're missing out on those returns, too bad. Me. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
And I think for advisors, the way when I speak to advisors about these things, I think that, we're all trying to get, two things from our clients. Number one is trust, right? Like building trust as an advisor with your client is paramount. There's no trust. There's no relationship. That is the foundation of our business. And then number two is compliance, right? Like we want our clients to feel good, putting away a little bit, socking away every month, getting those regular contributions flowing through, keeping our accounts topped up. We need them to feel good, and be in compliance with the investment plan that we've laid out. And that really, as it relates to sustainable investing broadly, that's really, to me, this is one of the best tools for advisors. Because when you are able to meet someone where their values are and connect with them and really listen to them about what they care about, what is the future that you want to retire into? What is the economy that you want your kids to graduate into? And you're able to go there with them and listen, not tell them, not sell them, but listen and then say, you know what? I hear you. And here's an approach that we can do that is in alignment. Oh my goodness, the trust goes through the roof, right? They're not going to go somewhere else. If it's a bad quarter or a bad year, whatever, they're not going to start shopping around for another advisor because, you're someone that they trust and that has listened to them. And then number two is the compliance piece that, Pierre, I have an interesting client base. The folks who find me are definitely more on the, crunchy granola. I've worked with vegans. I've worked with anarchists. I've worked with some people very much on the, sort of a little bit more out there than I think the typical advisor. But people, especially young people, I think are questioning capitalism quite a bit, right? And they're just saying, geez, this is not working for the planet. This is not working for a lot of people. Whatever the issue is for them, whether it's housing affordability, income inequality, climate change, plastic in the oceans, we could go on and on, right? But for a lot of folks, they're saying, geez, like, what the heck are we doing here? And I'm a part of that. They're going to question putting their money aside every single month. That compliance piece becomes a lot harder for them when they have not sort of like bought in to the system. So when there is some skepticism there, again, by going there with them, by hearing them out, saying your concerns are valid, I understand and appreciate them. And here, even though it's not perfect, but here's a portfolio that we can have that at least you can sort of assuage some of those concerns, then you're in a point where it's just the compliance becomes automatic. People are just going to be setting aside every single month without question. And I will say with the impact investment, this is going to be really hard for advisors. This is one of the big reasons why I use a fee-for-service business model, that I'm not a registered advisor or dealer, because oftentimes these things fall outside of the purview. They're not going to have, a CUSIP. They're not going to have a fund serve code or a ticker symbol. These community bonds are often things that investors are doing directly. Now that's changing as the ecosystem evolves, and I'm helping push that forward to say, hey, how do we get some impact, deep impact products on the shelf, you know, for advisors? But at this moment in time, you know, these are things where advisors are going to have to be a little bit careful, you know, in terms of, you know, recommending specific investment, you know, impact investments, things like community bonds. And if a client does go in that direction, it's probably coming out of their book. You know, so again, you know, some incentive issues there, but that, you know, I think the big thing is just being open to it, that not dismissing it out of hand. And then, you know, certainly that's where, you know, I can kind of come in handy for some advisors. I've got some good relationships where they're saying, you know what, okay, you know, I'll handle the sort of 97% of your portfolio that is, you know, market rates of return. And then, you know, for this 3%, you know, here, you can go talk to Tim. Like, let's go look at his list, make some decisions for yourself, you know, but knowing that there are some really, really cool impact investments on the market.
Yeah, you know, there's what comes to mind is that there's, you know, if you're not listening, like you're running a real, like what comes to mind is, you know, if you have a client who is talking to you about things, issues, objectives, or things that really matter to them from a values standpoint, or they come to you and they say, oh, you know, I'm in my community, there's this opportunity to invest in this situation, and I'm interested, what are your thoughts on that? And if, you know, if you turn around and you say, you know, why would you want to do that? You know, I don't recommend it. You know, without actually hearing it out, without actually airing it all out and finding out more about what it is the client has brought to your, you know, your doorstep, I think you run the risk of almost coming off like, you're sending the message to your client, oh, that's naive, or you know, grow up, that doesn't work, why would you do that, there's no money in that, there's no return, you know, like the risk of doing that is very high, you know, like, and I mean, ask and answer, the client is the one saying, you know, I think I'd like to do this, and here's why. But if you're not listening to the why and giving it the, you know, giving it the notice that it deserves, and basically you're dismissing what something that potentially matters greatly to your client. And that, you know, I can't think of a faster way to lose a client than, you know, the client feeling unheard or ignored when, you know, I tried to tell you about it, you know, I went to another advisor, because when I spoke to them about it, they told me, that advisor told me, sure, let's have a look. Let's get to the heart of it. What do you want to do here? What are you trying to accomplish by doing this?
And this is a huge gap in the marketplace. Yeah. The Responsible Investment Association, the RIA, you know, they do a survey every year. They find that, you know, when they ask regular Canadians, you know, about these topics, in the ballpark of about 60 to 65% of Canadians are interested in sustainable investing to some degree. What they find is that only about 25 to 30% have ever had the conversation with their advisor, or, you know, either brought it up or had it brought up with them. And then when I look at assets under management in terms of the socially responsible funds, you know, I put it at about 2% of total assets in Canada, of retail, not institutional, but retail, are actually inside of these responsible investment funds. So to me, there's a huge gap here between what clients want and what advisors are doing. And I think there's just a massive opportunity, you know, certainly I've seen it with my business and the way I've seen it grow. And that, no doubt, Pierre, I've had, so many horror stories of people coming to me because, to your point, they brought it up with their advisor and their advisor just didn't listen to them at all. And that, you know, they felt terrible coming out of that meeting. And so what do? They start shopping around.
Yeah. So, I mean, for advisors, the key is to, you know, put down, you know, set aside your own personal convictions in favor of being more open-minded when it comes to, you know, clients coming to you with ideas of their own.
No question.
Whether they're good or not. I mean, whether they're good, you know, whether you feel good, bad, or indifferent about their ideas, you know, what actually matters here is not whether or not you're going to allow them or you're going to put the stamp of approval on it for them. What matters to the client is, did you listen to me when I brought this to you? Did you listen to me when I asked you about it? Or did you just set me, you know, set my inquiry aside as unimportant because it doesn't fit in with what you think is the right way to do things, right? I mean, it's such a high, you know, it's a very, you know, it's both a very humbling business on one hand. I mean, it's humbling when you lose. It's humbling when you make the wrong call. It's humbling definitely when a client walks. But it's also at the same time, it's a very egotistical business. It's very high conviction. It's very, you know, you ask me for my opinion. Here's my opinion. The danger is that, you know, that gap between the humility and the egotism to be open-minded and say, okay, maybe I need to listen to what you're saying and have a good look at it for you. And, you know, whatever my opinion is, if you still want to go ahead and do it, by all means.
And Pierre, a great tactic that I use is I often kind of, you know, talk about sort of wearing different hats. You know, I'll never forget, I have one fellow come to me, you know, approaching retirement, you know, doesn't have a lot of money socked away, right? And he's like, Tim, I want to go all in on hydrogen. Like hydrogen companies, I want to put every penny into hydrogen stocks. And I'm like, oh, right away. And then, but again, you know, can't dismiss it. So, you know, what I'll often do in these situations is say, okay, listen, like wearing my sort of environmentalist hat or my sustainability hat or, you know, technological thing, but then wearing my financial planner hat, my CFP hat, you know, let's look at this from a purely financial standpoint and what I can do there. And so I find kind of having these hats. And so I think that so many advisors kind of only wear the finance first hat. They see their job entirely as I'm, you know, fiduciary. I'm looking out for your financial interests. That's it. Right. And then I think with sustainability, you know, and this broader, this notion of extra financial information, it allows you to kind of put on a different hat, right? Where you can say, okay, I'm going to put on my dad hat for a minute. Because if you're coming to me with concerns about climate change, right? Because that was really the issue was, you know, this fellow was very worried about climate change, saw hydrogen as a great solution, you know, wanted to sort of, you know, profit from that. Whereas I'm saying, okay, I'm going to put my climate scientist hat on for a minute and fully agree with you that we're in a climate crisis and that we need solutions there. There are a bunch of different technologies, right? Is hydrogen going to be it? Maybe, maybe not. You know, let's look, we can kind of look at it through that lens and kind of have that conversation. But then wearing my financial planner hat, my CFP hat, this is a terrible idea, right? Like diversification is the name of the game. You know, certainly we can carve out part of your portfolio. I'll often do this. It's a similar vein as, you know, in terms of the impact investment, the sort of 1% to 3%, where if people want to, you know, make bets and have their own, you know, they have a hot tip that they got from a locker room or something, I'll say, sure, we can carve out part of your portfolio. I call it mad money, and you can do whatever you want. You know, 9 times out of 10, you're going to come back to me in a couple of years with your tail between your legs and realize you don't want to do the mad money anymore. But sure, you know, if we can view this as a learning experience, if you really want to do that, but you know, let's put some guardrails on it. And that, you know, and so to me, it's just, you know, wearing those different hats, I think it's so critical for advisors. And that, you know, this has been the issue. The folks who do come to me because they're shopping around and they're, you know, firing their old advisor, it's because their old advisor wasn't capable of wearing different hats, frankly, that they just, you know, they wore that financial first, we're going to maximize returns at any and all costs. You know, this is how I do it. I find a lot of advisors also, you know, we have these preferences for styles of investing. So whether it's cap weighted, whether it's, you know, looking at factor weighting, whether, you know, you're big into alternatives or certain, you know, we often get kind of, you know, stick ourselves in rocks where this is my approach, this is my system, this is how I do it. And anything outside of that is bunk. And, you know, I just really want people to understand that I think a big part of the job is empathy and is listening and is understanding that someone's goals, yes, we are helping them meet their financial goals, no question. But at the same time, there are family goals tied up into that. You know, there are societal goals tied into that, you know, and that when we are able to sort of, you know, get out of our box a little bit, open up our hearts and kind of connect with them on some of those levels, that's where you just have the best conversations That's where, you know, the clients who have invited me to their wedding or have sent me, you know, baby photos, or where it really is like, this is like a lifelong relationship that we're walking their financial journey together, that sort of partnership, you know, that's where those clients have come from, is from me really realizing that this is more than money. Yes, the money part is very important, and we're always going to cover those bases and make sure that we're, you know, approaching it from that lens. And, you know, I'm happy to go a little bit beyond that in terms of our conversations to get to the heart of not only sort of what we're investing in, but why we're investing. What are the goals? I see too many people facing retirement with huge amount of money in their retirement accounts now and don't know how to spend it and don't know what to do with it. And are just like, you know, in this great position where they've got more than enough and they're like, well, what now? And it's just like, well, okay, you know, now we get to talk about these bigger picture things, you know, what really matters to you. And, you know, how do we align not only your spending and your giving goals, but also your investments?
You know, you hear about these, you know, sometimes crazy stories about billionaires leaving their entire fortune to their dog, you know, and that just, that to me, it doesn't speak to the dog, but it, you know, it speaks to the fact that that person felt like no one else is deserving because they didn't listen to anything I had to say, or they didn't care for me or about me. So, you know, it is a relationship business. I mean, the business of advising is as much about, if not more, about relationships. I think, you know, when a client comes to you, you don't have to even believe, you don't have to be on board with sustainable investing or ESG or any of that in order to facilitate your client's demand or desire. I mean, your client's desire. If a client comes to you and says, I'm thinking about investing in hydrogen, you know, for your example, Tim, I'm thinking about investing in hydrogen. Say, well, okay, why don't we do the proper amount of due diligence on that? Why don't we just lay it all out on the table and then you decide, do you still want to do it? To your point, which is that, you know, it's like, as advisors, we're time constrained, right? Okay, you know, okay, that means I'm going to have to spend 6 hours or 10 hours gathering all the info on hydrogen for you so that I can lay it all out on the table for you. But, you know, if you care about the relationship with the client, then that's more important than whether or not you believe they're doing the right thing, right? Let the client make the final decision if that's what it comes to about whether or not they should do it, but approach the diligence exercise with objectivity as opposed to judgment.
That's it. And it's not going to take you 6 to 10 hours, Pierre. Like,
no.
You know, really, and obviously if they're coming with penny stocks and things like that. But, you know, for me, I really love the ETF market. You know, that's kind of primarily where I play, our ETFs. I've got some great free resources on my website, goodinvesting.com, where, you know, I've got my sort of lists of all the different sustainable ETFs that are on the market. So you can go through the thematic funds and, you know, find one that is sort of clean energy focused. And then, you know, from there, just it's very, very easy to be able to identify some names that are, you know, in specific hydrogen thing. But I'm always reminding clients that diversification is a core value, that the way we build a resilient ecosystem is through diversification. The way we build a resilient portfolio is through diversification, right? So it really is reminding folks of these sort of main tenets of investing in, and again, these sort of core values that we use, and that really it's about getting alignment on those core values. And then it really is often these conversations are upfront. You know, if you've had a client for, you know, decades, it's unlikely they're going to, you know, come to you with some of these specific, you know, products or concerns. Usually it's some of the newer clients who are like, you know, want to test you out on this stuff. You know, if they do, obviously great. Like you've earned, you know, decades worth of fees from them. Do your due diligence there. It's, you know, it's, they've already paid for that. And that, but it is kind of newer folks. It is also new, you know, sort of when parents are passing on money to their kids. Like, I think this is really the critical piece, that when these these conversations do come up for advisors is that, you know, we know the intergenerational transfer of wealth that's taking place right now. There are so many Canadians who have more than enough as they get into retirement, who are looking at early inheritances, who are looking at passing down wealth, whether it's help with down payments or whether it's help, you know, maxing out your RSPs and TFSAs, right? But we're seeing that a lot. And that to me is where these conversations are absolutely critical, because if it is a child of a client who comes to you with questions around this, this is where I see a lot of advisors muck it up, because they are going to be, you know, they're going to be taking over those big accounts, you know, some way. And so this is really the opportunity to invest that time, to have those conversations, to ensure that there is values alignment, right? And getting them into the right strategy so that they feel good about the relationship, you know, for the coming decades.
At the heart of it all, really at the relationship level, I think it's the open-mindedness. It's truly being able to be objective and listening listening actively, but also to discover, you know, the intent. Because no matter what you believe personally as an advisor, you know, your role is to, you know, facilitate your clients' wishes and values for how, you know, what their investment objectives are, why they want those objectives met, you know, what their intentions are specifically for their assets. I think because of our training as advisors, you know, we can sometimes, without realizing it, be very limited in our ability to have the open-minded conversations without jumping to conclusions or without saying no right off the bat or without passing, you know, judgment on whether or not an investment opportunity is good or not. So you know, let's continue, Tim. I just want to change gears for a moment. From your perspective, what would you say distinguishes meaningful, responsible investing from practices that fall short?
Yeah. So this gets to this notion of sort of lip service, greenwashing, right? And so I think, one of the big problems has been with some of the marketing behind ESG funds where, you know, it really is, there are just certain companies, mutual fund companies, ETF providers that, you know, just kind of slap an ESG label on something and it's a mirrored index, you know, and you're just getting the same old, same old. So, you know, to me, it really is understanding specifically around ESG with that label, that this idea of ESG integration, that we are using ESG data. The problem is that ESG integration is so broad and you can consider ESG criteria with the tiniest little weight and still, you know, give yourself that stamp. Well, at least I considered it. It didn't impact my decisions at all, but I considered ESG, right? So to me, what you're really going to want to do is look under the hood, look at the holdings. Again, to me, it's understanding what does the client want between these three different strategies, divestment versus ESG integration versus stewardship. To me, in a dream world, we're kind of doing all three, that there are some exclusions. And again, this is going to be client specific. One of the big things on client expectations, a big one is going to be around fossil fuels, right? If someone is very climate concerned and that's a top issue for them and you open it up and, you know, Enbridge is a top holding and ExxonMobil is still in there, you know, that's going to be a huge red flag. You're going to lose a lot of trust there. So understanding which exclusions they are expecting to have. And if a fund does not have those exclusions, know that that's going to be a bit of an issue for them. On the ESG integration, it really is about, you know, understanding how, to what extent they do ESG integration. Right. This is where you do have to dig a little bit deeper, looking at different weightings. You know, really what we're looking at are those deviations from the standard benchmarks. You know, are they earning? They should be able to earn the same returns, but have an ESG tilt. And then on the stewardship side, you know, it's really fun for me digging through some of these shareholder resolution, the voting. You can see very clearly, you know, when there's a climate, you know, proposition and the management has suggested that investors vote against it and the fund has also voted against it. You know, that's telling me, okay, their proxy voting guidelines aren't very strong. So, you know, those are going to be the things that I really look at. And then from there, you know, that's more on the passive side. Obviously, on the active side, it is having a fund manager who really just gets it, who doesn't pay service to it. You know, you can hear from interviews with them. You can sort of look at their background. Those of us, you know, in the marketplace usually can have some degree of access to the manager. And so it's just really about asking them, you know, and again, it's the same questions. What are the exclusions that you have? What are the no-goes for this fund? You know, how are you integrating ESG criteria into the investment decision making? And then, you know, what is the proxy voting record? And being able to ascertain those three things will give you a very clear idea about how seriously a fund manager is taking sustainability.
I'm curious, like when you, because it's in your wheelhouse, Tim, I'm curious to know what your thoughts are, how good of a job are companies like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street doing when it comes to the voting?
Yeah. It's, you know, on the voting side, it's been a little bit tricky to ascertain. You know, BlackRock was a leader and then now they've pulled back. So that's where it's been really frustrating. They've been the most, I would say, sort of blowing with the winds where, you know, Larry Fink had wrote his letters and it was all about ESG and sustainability and this is the future. And then now all of a sudden, you know, we've got a new administration, a different political reality south of the border. And they were not going to talk about those things nearly as much. So, that's the case there. Bluntly, as I've seen, I haven't really looked at State Street. That would be an interesting question. Vanguard.
Well, any of the very large index active or passive, of the large asset managers in the top 10, like what kind of voting records are you seeing, and are they voting in accordance with those guidelines? Or
the ones that take it the most seriously are active managers in terms of groups like Desjardins, NEI, Northwest Ethical Investments, and BMO. Surprisingly to me, has a very, very strong proxy voting team. And then as well, you know, any firm that engages, there's a wonderful organization called SHARE, the Shareholder Association for Research and Education, SHARE, SHARE, and they're phenomenal. So to me, if I see that someone has outsourced it to SHARE, right away, I feel good about the situation. You know, when it's someone like ISS or Glass Lewis, I think is the other sort of big firm in this space, you know, okay, let's see. We're going to have to actually look at the voting record. Maybe, maybe not. And then unfortunately, a lot of the ETFs just don't. I think that there is some room there for, you know, this is part of my role on the advocacy side is saying, hey, you know, if I can shine a light on that a little bit, like we need to do better there. But at the same time, you know, it really is about understanding that whether are they doing it internally, right? Versus if they're outsourcing it. And if they're outsourcing it, to me, it's, you know, head and shoulders above is going to be anybody who's working with SHARE.
Interesting. I want to come back to the discussion around skills gap, you know, because we touched on it contextually, but you mentioned you talk a lot about the skills gap in sustainable investing. What kinds of knowledge, experience or perspectives do you believe are missing in the industry at large today?
Yeah, I have a lot to say on this. You know, for me, I really do come from sort of the two different worlds of investments. Like I grew up with my dad as an investment advisor for, you know, it was Midland Walwin, Merrill Lynch, and then, you know, National Bank Financial, right? And then my studies in sustainability, where I learned systems thinking, I learned engineering for a sustainable society, human behavior, psychology, as well as the science behind environmental issues. And, you know, it's so rare to have somebody that has the knowledge in both finance and sustainability. So this is part of my mission is to kind of bridge the gap between those two. And so I often find myself going into investment spaces like I am here today, and I'll kind of use a bit of a finance first language and talk about market rates of return and risk adjusted returns and, you know, that financial language, and then showing how sustainability impacts that. And then, you know, when I go into a sustainability space, you know, for an environmental space or social justice organization, I'm using a lot of their language. And then showing how the economics and the finance stuff kind of fits into those models. And that what I've seen is that, you know, it's just a rare skill set. You know, what I am seeing is that someone who is more likely to understand both sides is more likely to go into the buy side, rather than the sell side of the business. So there are some amazing analysts, both, you know, CFAs and financial analysts, as well as ESG analysts who kind of, you know, embody both of those knowledge bases. But when it comes to the soft skills, you know, the people that are a little bit more predisposed to the sell side of the business, you know, this is where I find that there is a big self-selection bias, that the type of person who wants to become an investment advisor, frankly, Pierre, like, usually has a very political, conservative worldview, right? Is doing it for reasons of, you know, wealth and money, and, you know, tends to lean in that direction. And as a result, just has not pursued a lot of the more, you know, sort of softer skills around, you know, effective communication, deep listening, systems thinking, you know, and the some of the skills that I think are really critical to bridging the gap. So to me, it does come down to, you know, in our business, I would say more of the EQ rather than the IQ is kind of the skills gap that's missing.
Absolutely.
Right. And and there are some amazing people that are, you know, working on that. When I look south of the border, you know, who is it, like Michael Kitsis, and there's some amazing, I'm trying to remember his name now, but Daniel, I'm trying to remember, but certainly, you know, on the behavioral side, even Daniel Kahneman, I can remember that. And, you know, some of the folks there who are really recognizing the links between behavior and behavioral sciences and finance. So we're getting that, but what we're not getting is the values side. You know, I'm still sort of the odd duck here saying that, hey, like, you know, the values that someone has should really shape and influence, you know, the investment portfolio that we've got them in. That's an idea that certainly hasn't sort of, you know, spread through the investment industry yet. So to me, it really is, you know, understanding psychology, understanding systems change theories. And that really, I would say, almost like it's like conflict resolution and this idea of sort of like, you know, nonviolent conflict resolution. Like, how do we actually have conversations with folks who have a different worldview than us, right? Is I think such a critical skill. And then from there, go ahead.
It's interesting. I'm just thinking about something that, you know, I learned to do as an advisor, which I wish I had learned sooner in my time as an advisor, but maybe about 7 years in to my 15 years as an advisor. But one of the best things I ever learned was a framework of prompting or questioning conversations, which always started with the question, what's important about money to you, right? And that was actually one of the most valuable things that I think I ever learned in my entire career about eliciting a client's high criteria or their high values. Because you ask that question, what's important about money to you, people will tell you what they think they can trade it for. And you started the conversation in today's conversation with that, which is that, you know, money means different things to different people. And if you can figure that out very early on, and speak to it with your clients, you know, if it's about freedom, if it's about security, you know, there's all these gigantic, you know, headings that people have for what they think about, you know, what they think money means to them, having it, that is, and what they would do with it. That's probably the most important questions you want to lead with at the beginning of an onboarding process, you know, bringing on a new client or a new prospect, prospective client. And I don't think a lot of people do that, because it's not an easy conversation to have. But once you master how to have that conversation and how to take it to its nth degree, for example, what's important about money to you? Security. Well, what's important about security to you? What does that mean? And then the next level, and then the next level. You take it all the way down to, you know, it's like the five whys. Keep asking, yes. Why. Why do you want that? Why do you want that? Why do you want to do that? Why do you want to accomplish that? What's important about that to you? that process of unlocking your client's values is probably the most valuable exercise you'll do. And then, of course, the next step is knowing how to implement it, knowing what to do with that information once you have it, how to make it, you know, real for the client, so that you know, everything that you do aligns with the elicitation of those values, those high values that they hold.
That's it. I mean, I sort of have modified my KYC form, yeah. You know, the Know Your Client form, and, you know, some of my favorite questions that are on there that might, you know, encourage people to figure out their own, but the ones that I find work really well. But, you know, number one is just, you know, where do you volunteer, you know, your time and your money in terms of charitable donations? And if you volunteer on any boards or any causes that are important, because right away I can, you know, just pinpoint certain issues that, you know, if someone tells me that they're deeply involved with cancer research and issues, and, you know, right away, okay, I'm thinking maybe tobacco might be something that, you know, might be an important thing for you, right? If it's animal rights organizations or climate change, okay, that's going to give me really valuable information. Probably my favorite question is, if you won the lottery today, what would you do differently tomorrow? Like, if money wasn't an issue, would you quit your job? Would you, you know, what would you do?
Exactly.
How would you spend that?
Those are really fun, you know, right? Those are really fun questions that can unlock the conversation.
And it becomes easy. Then it's, you know, then it's not a hard conversation. It's not a,
exactly.
Like, this is great. People love that.
There's so many ways to go about it. Yeah.
And then from there, and then to your point, it then allows me, gives me little clues to say, okay, like, I, you know, for me, that question is honestly about how much risk, like, this is more of a risk tolerance question or an emergency fund question than anything else. Mm-hmm. Like, how happy are they if they tell me, Tim, I would quit my job the first thing tomorrow morning, you know, that tells me they might be in for a career shift, you know, sooner than anticipated. Whereas if someone says, oh, I would never quit my job. I'm going to keep going there no matter what. Right. So it really, there are these little clues. I would absolutely urge people, you know, when it comes to knowing your client, yes, we want to know the financial information, no question. And we also want to get into some of these values-based questions. There's a wonderful human needs framework that I use, this Chilean economist named Manfred Max Neef. You know, I think a lot of people know the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? We talk a lot about that. Manfred Max Neef has a different framework where it's sort of these 10 different fundamental human needs, you know, protection, security is one of them, freedom, identity, leisure time is a big thing. And so often what I'm doing is kind of using that knowledge to, as folks are talking, to be able to say, okay, what are the things that might be a little bit bone dry, you know, in terms of some of their needs that aren't being fulfilled right now? Where are the cups really full? Where, you know, okay, we don't have to worry about that so much. Because really what it comes down to me is that, you know, we want people to achieve this greater sense of prosperity, that it's not just about wealth, right? That money is a means to an end. So what is that higher end, this notion of prosperity, right? This notion of well-being, this notion of happiness. And that what we can often do as financial planners, investment advisors, is to ground the conversation there, getting them thinking at that higher level, realizing that, hey, we have to be really smart about your personal finances to be able to get you to the point where we're meeting those higher needs.
I mean, at the very least, it can be such a great way to deepen the relationship with clients, is to have these conversations, no matter where they end up, where they lead. When you like, Tim, when you think about the future of responsible investing, where do you see the most important opportunities or areas of progress?
Yeah, you know, I really think, so we've come so far. Like, when I started my blog, you brought up at the start, you introduced, you know, I had sustainableeconomist.com and I was building these sort of, you know, model portfolios for folks. And it was a nightmare. If somebody wanted to divest from fossil fuels, you know, it was like I had to do sector by sector and exclude certain things. And, you know, it was a 12 fund portfolio. And now we have all in one ETFs that are fossil fuel free by BlackRock iShares. Like, literally, there's a one ETF solution that can, you know, hit a whole bunch of those goals. So, so really to me, you know, when I do look at the future, I see a couple things. Number one is, I do think that it is on a macro level that I think we are still a little bit stuck right now in this notion of sort of GDP growth and sort of more, you know, I talked before about net worth equals self-worth. And I think as a country, you know, we are still thinking that if, you know, if only we had more money, if only our GDP was, you know, growing by 3%, it would solve all of our problems. And it's like, no, no, no. I think we do need this more holistic view of things. So this idea of externalities, incorporating externalities, you know, this notion of well-being and happiness on a macro level, I think is absolutely critical. And I think once we understand it up there, that that's necessarily going to trickle down into our investment portfolio. Because where we are seeing the action is, I mentioned earlier that on the retail side, it's only about 2% of assets are invested in responsible, sustainable ESG products. On the institutional level, it's more than 50%. You know, Canadian CPPIB, Canadian Pension Plan, Caisse de dépôt et placement, you know, Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, like the biggest institutional investors, all the quote unquote smart money is all over ESG analysis and research. I've got a number of friends who are working within those organizations, and I can assure you, like, they get it. Right. And so when it comes to the institutional investors, you know, they absolutely get it, such that this has already started impacting valuations. So I think where it does need to kind of trickle down again is into the retail market. That what we do need is for advisors, to your point, to just have an open mind about it, just whatever preconceived notions, just like let that drop, focus on, you know, really connecting the relationship with the advisor, right? I think what that'll do is if advisors can really kind of embrace this sort of, you know, this way of thinking where it's like, hey, we're still going to earn market rates of return, but I'm going to have a stronger relationship with my client. You know, that's a win-win-win across the board. That, you know, that's when we will start to see more assets going there. And then what I'm really excited for is the growing ecosystem around the impact investments. These things like community bonds, green bonds, Pierre. We've gone, you know, 10 years ago, there were hardly any. I think last year, over $1 trillion of green bonds got issued globally. Like, green bonds are just an absolute force in the marketplace right now. The green bond market is incredible. So I think, you know, what we are going to see is this notion of, you know, specific issues, these kind of like, you know, specific themes. And that really as these things do materialize more in the public consciousness, you know, we are going to see that, you know, new products get created that align with those issues. And then, you know, more investment uptake, you know, certainly from the institutions. And, you know, I'm hopeful on the retail side as well.
So Tim, if folks want to find out more about what you do, where can they find you? How can they find you?
Yeah, so my website is goodinvesting.com. I've got a YouTube channel and a podcast. So it's Good Investing with Tim Nash. So if people search for those on YouTube or in their podcast app, then they should be able to find that. And my email is tim@goodinvesting.com or add me on LinkedIn.
Excellent. Tim, it's been terrific to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and insight.
Pierre, I'm so happy to be here. You know, always happy to have a great chat with you.